Booker Prize-winning novel, The English Patient, later made into an Academy Award-winning film. Born in Sri Lanka, he traveled alone by ship to England at age 11 to live with his mother, who he hadn't seen in several years since his parents were divorced. This boyhood journey became the inspiration for his latest novel. It's called The Cat's Table. Michael Ondaatje joins me in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Delighted to have you. You can join us. Those of you who've read The English Patient and other works by Michael Ondaatje, please give us a call, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. I'm sure you get this all the time, but the first question I have to ask you is your name. It's such an unusual name, Ondaatje. What's its ethnic origins?
Well, it looks like a Dutch name, but I think my family originally came from India to Sri Lanka, or Ceylon, as it was called then. And when the Dutch invaded, the very good, smart businessmen made their names look like they were Dutch names. So they added the AA and the TJ and so forth. So it was probably, you know, phonetically a very easily spelled name, but now it was more complicated and classy, as they would say.
And you've described yourself. You've used the word mongrel to describe yourself. But what did you mean by that word?
Well, I think, my family, originally, at Tamil, they would marry the Dutch or the English or the Sinhalese, and so there was a kind of great mixture. You know, I can't really kind of decode the source of it all. And I'm a mongrel of not just of, race, but place and languages. And, I left Sri Lanka when I was 11, went to England, then I came to Canada. So I've I'm a cultural mongrel, I think.
And you write that you actually saw a version of your family name on a village in Sri Lanka. And I must say, I've had exactly the same experience going back to Poland and seeing an earlier version of my family name, which was Rogowski, on a village. So
right.
tell that story.
What I was there actually after the tsunami, and I was in this village on the East Coast, and there was a town called Ondaatje Madam, and Ondaatje was spelled O-N-D-A-C-H-C-H-I, and I just fell in love with the spelling of it. I really wanted to change my name a bit late in my career.
There's something almost mystical about seeing your name on the name of a town.
I've had
the same experience.
Yeah, and I think Ondaatje Madam meant, in fact, a village of people who did metalwork in temples. So, so that was probably one of the first professions of my family in Sri Lanka.
You mentioned that you left Sri Lanka, then Ceylon at age 11. The protagonist in your novel leaves Ceylon at age 11, gets on a boat. Talk about the origins of the idea. I gather you've used the word. There was a fragment of memory lodged in your brain that blossomed into this work.
Well, I was talking to my children a few years ago, and they're all adults now. And I mentioned that, I'd been put on this ship without any family control or discipline for 21 days. And they were outraged. This is appalling. We wouldn't put our kids on a bus for half a day, let alone 21 days on a ship. And I realized it actually was a very strange thing that had happened to me. And I also realized it was a gift. It was a gift of an idea for a story. And I don't really remember very much of that journey, sadly. And I remember playing ping pong and, swimming and so forth. But I don't remember very much of it. So I thought, here I've been given this gift of an idea for a novel. And so I began the novel very authentically with an 11-year-old boy, quite scared, getting onto a ship at night. And then almost within three or four pages, I was writing fiction. I had two other boys, one named Ramadan, one named Cassius. And, they joined me in a kind of gang. And so those boys and all the characters on the ship were fictional characters that I invented. And then I created a kind of adventure story for them, and full of bad behavior and pranks and so forth. And then a prisoner comes into the story, and then it gets more and more complicated, and there's a kind of murder possibility that happens in the book.
But you've written often and spoken in interviews that you operate on sort of the edge of reality and sort of this shadowy boundary land between fiction and reality. So the book was infused with memory and with some facts of your life. The protagonist is named Michael, although you say you didn't even start out that way. But how do you thread your way through that borderland?
Well, when I'm writing, whether it's this book or The English Patient or whatever it is, I usually begin with a kind of place and a time period. and I need a kind of a very exact location. And I usually begin with a sense of nonfiction in the book. You know, that the fact that when the Germans left Italy, they left a lot of mines on the roads and on the houses and so forth. And that was an interesting factoid, as Mailer would say. And so I kind of used that and then started investigating the story and then quickly became fictional. One of the things about writing a book about a ship journey in the 1950s, especially if it's an adventure story or a boy's own adventure story, is you have to try and make it authentic in some way. You can't just leap into fiction, and you have to give a sense of reality to it. And for me, the way I could do it was to have a kind of aura of memoir, so that the boy is called Michael and becomes a writer later in his life. And the school he went to was the school that I went to in Sri Lanka, and also the school in England he goes to. So, and then he ends up in Canada. So all of these things are there, but they're really kind of, in a way, red herrings. You know, they're there to kind of persuade you that this is as believable as possible. And so that kind of mix of fact and fiction is kind of a weapon. You know, there's a great remark by Kinky Friedman, which I love to quote, which is, there's a very fine line between fiction and nonfiction, and I think I snorted it in 1976.
Now, of course, the title of the book, The Cat's Table, is a phrase from one of your characters. As you mentioned, Michael, the 11-year-old, has these two pals, and they get exiled to this table with a bunch of oddball characters in the corner of the dining room. And is that a real phrase? Is that did you make it up, or did you hear it somewhere?
I didn't make it up. In fact, I heard it from a German publisher, and they said they'd had a dream where they were sitting at some big banquet, but they were sitting at the cat's table, and that meant the lowliest table in the banquet hall, which is usually, you know, by the restaurant, by the kitchens or something like that.
Now, you mentioned there are many adventures, and I'd love for you to read a passage from the book for our listeners that give us some sense of this world that you've plunged these three young boys into.
Okay. In the hour before dawn, when we got up to roam what felt like a deserted ship, the cavernous saloons smelled of the previous night's cigarettes, and Ramadan and Cassius and I would already have turned the silent library into a mayhem of rolling trolleys. One morning we suddenly found ourselves hemmed in by a girl on roller skates racing round the wooden perimeter of the upper deck. It seemed she had been getting up even earlier than we had. There was no acknowledgement on her part of our existence as she raced faster and faster, the fluent strides testing her balance. On one turn, mistiming a cornering leap over cables, she crashed into the stern railing, got up, looked at the slash of blood on her knee, and continued glancing at her watch. She was Australian, and we were enthralled. We had never witnessed such determination. None of the female members of our families had behaved this way. Later we recognized her in the pool, her speed a barrage of water. It would not have surprised us if she'd leapt off the Oronze into the sea and kept pace for 20 minutes alongside the ship. We therefore began waking even earlier to watch her roller skate the 50 or 60 laps. When she was finished, she'd unlace her skates and walk, exhausted, sweating and fully clothed, towards the outdoor shower. She would stand in the gush and spray of it, tossing her hair this way, that way, like some clothed animal. This was a new kind of beauty. When she left, we followed her footprints, which were already evaporating in the new sunlight as we approached them. We were by now fully knowledgeable about most locations on the ship, from the path air ducts took in their journey away from the turbine propellers to how I could slip into the fish preparation room by crawling through a trolley exit. We had discovered the door to the armory had a buggered latch, and when the room was empty, we strolled through it, handling the revolvers and handcuffs. And we knew each lifeboat contained a compass, a sail, a rubber raft, plus emergency chocolate bars that we had already eaten.
One of the wonderful lines you attribute to these three lads is, each day we vowed to do something prohibited.
That's right. That's right.
And I love that idea that they were liberated. It's almost this Disneyland of adventure, unrestrained by parental limits or supervision.
Yes, and also that fact, I mean, it really was a case of, that no parents were there. There was one woman in first class who was supposed to watch over Michael. And in fact, there was a woman who was supposed to look after me on the real ship, but I never ever saw her. But I saw her as a possible Lady Bracknell type. So in this book, she keeps appearing every now and then, is outraged by his behavior and lying.
But there's also this sense of exploration and at the same time invisibility. In the expert these lads can squeeze into places, metaphorical as well as real, without anybody really noticing them.
Yes, and because they're boys, they are invisible to the officials on the ship. You know, I think that's kind of great freedom of youth. I think, you know, because we don't really. We are not aware of kids watching us as adults, you know, and kids look at adults as if they were dogs, you know. I mean, as if the kids were dogs. They sense who likes them, who doesn't like them, who's powerful, who's not powerful, but they don't understand the motives behind anything.
And you also give Michael your own name, but then you give him a nickname, Mina, which you hint foreshadows his life as a writer.
Well, I mean, what happens in the book, without giving too much away, is that Michael becomes a writer and Cassius becomes a painter. So Cassius is the watcher, and Michael is the guy who repeats all the stories he hears, like a minor bird. So I think that was a hint in the book.
My guest this hour is Michael Ondaatje. His new novel is The Cat's Table. Of course, you know him well as the Booker Prize-winning author of The English Patient, made into the Oscar-winning movie. So if you want to give us a call, 1-800-433-8850. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. My guest this hour is Michael Ondaatje, the famous novelist, Booker Prize-winning author of The English Patient. His new novel, The Cat's Table, is just out. You can join our conversation, 1-800-433-8850. We got some lines open, or email us, drshow@wamu.org. And Michael, it's the subtext of this novel is this journey. It's not just life on the ship. It's where that journey started and where it ended. It started in your original native land of Sri Lanka, then Ceylon, and you come to England. You yourself have talked often about feeling exiled in England, and that you knew the world of Sri Lanka, but everything had changed when you got to England. And the novel is infused with that sense of your character, Michael. And some of that strangeness and that exile and an immigrant journey is symbolized by his mother, who he hasn't seen in years and who's greeting him on the dock in this new country.
Right, right. No, I think one of the real things that the nonfiction element of the book is that kind of unawareness of where he's going. You know, I think an 11-year-old boy is plucked out of this island where he's lived and knows very well in a kind of feral kind of way. And he's on a ship with complete strangers and complete strange customs, and he's going to land in a country where the customs are even stranger. And what I remember about landing in England was that I was suddenly sent to a school where, you know, you had to wear a tie for the first time in your life and socks, which you never worn before in your life, and you had certain customs at the school that were kind of peculiarly, you know, traditional and bizarre. So it was really a case of adapting to a new country. I think one of the reasons I don't remember the ship journey very well is that I was like a cat landing on 4 feet in a new place, and I had to quickly adapt.
And isn't that the classic story of every immigrant in the history of the world moves to a new country, never quite feels fully at home in the new country, but really can't go back to the homeland again? And then you are suspended between two worlds.
I think so. And in fact, I was suspended between three worlds because, you know, at the age of 18, I went to Canada. Right. And I became a Canadian. One of the things that happened I saw in Canada was people who came over from England, and they kept talking about England for the rest of their lives. And in many ways, I didn't want to keep looking back. And I think when I came to England as an 11-year-old, I didn't want to keep looking back to Sri Lanka. You know, I never went back until I was about 35 years old. So I was, for a while, cocooned in that kind of colonial culture of Sri Lankans in London. You know, I had lots of uncles and aunts who were there and had lived there. And so every Sunday, you went off to somebody's house for a curry. And my mother would cook a curry, and various Sri Lankans would come for lunches or dinner. So there was a kind of other community there that existed, and which was not quite English. But then during the day, you went to a school and had to be very, very English.
And as you say, you really emigrated twice. Right. And is Canada home now? When you think of home, is that... does that burrowed into your soul and made itself at home, this country?
Well, very much so. I think I've lived in Canada since about 1963, so about almost 50 years now. And that's where my family is, and that's where my close friends are, and that's where I learned to write. So I think three of those elements are pretty much, you know, part of me. What's interesting as a writer was that when I grew up in Sri Lanka, I didn't really read many books. I must have learned how to read, but I didn't read any books about Sri Lanka. You know, the stories that I heard at the dinner table was the literature, you know, everyone lying or making excuses or creating alibis and so forth. And it wasn't until I went to England that I began to read. But in England, you had such a tradition of writers, of Keats and, you know, various people, that it would have been appalling to even think about writing. It wasn't until I got to Canada that I became a writer. I thought, here's a new country and
a new world.
A new world, and you can name things, you know.
And you can, in the same way that so many immigrants have journeyed to America, you can redefine yourself. The day you land the new world, you can become a new person.
Exactly. You know, and I went to Canada when I was 18, and I was coming to a new country, and at 18, you want to become a new person anyway, and so you change, and that's when you need literature to protect yourself in a way.
But, you know, we talked earlier about that, you know, your ethnic background and your self-description as a mongrel, and having moved and felt in England, you have curry on Sunday, which is a Tamil tradition, not an English tradition, right. And you go to an English school, so you're caught between worlds, never quite at home in either one. It seems to me, though, that seeing life at an angle that way as an outsider is a great advantage to a writer, and particularly a novelist. It gives you a perspective that is very useful.
Oh, it's terrific, because I think that's how you can see the kind of intricacies of people that, you know, the hidden intricacies. The people described in this ship are all kind of peculiar people in some way, and that's the result of this boy looking at them through Sri Lankan eyes, but in a new location. And, you know, it's a great gift to a writer to have that sense of, this is how people live in Canada, but I know that in Sri Lanka they live this way, you know, and you have a double vision of the world.
And one of the most interesting passages of the novel, I thought, was when you describe Michael as an adult goes back and sees paintings done by his young shipmate.
Right.
And he comes to realize that these are paintings of a scene that they shared together during the boat journey when the boat docked in at Suez Canal.
Right.
But painted from a certain angle.
Right.
And it struck me that that was a visual metaphor for what you were really talking about, this larger idea of seeing the world from a different perspective.
Exactly. And then also seeing the world from a point of view of an adult, because, you know, mm-hmm. the book began as a book from the point of view of an 11-year-old. And I thought it was going to stay that way. And then when the ship goes through the Suez Canal, you have this very vivid scene of the boys sitting on the railing, watching what's going on as they go past the various docks. And then you have this scene where he suddenly jumps to when he's in his 20s, going to a gallery and seeing Cassius's paintings. And that was a point in the book where I suddenly realized I had to have Michael as an adult as well. But, you know, what he recognizes in this art gallery is that the angle of the painting, the point of view of the paintings, is exactly the point of view from a railing of a ship looking down. And he recognizes the perspective. And that's what makes them moving to him.
And Cassius drew on his angle of observation in the same way the writer Michael does, in a similar way.
Yeah, it becomes a very central scene in the book because, you know, not until then do we suddenly kind of start having flash forwards and we see Ramadan in later life and we see Cassius in later life and Michael in later life.
Well, one other thing, then we're going to get to our callers, many of whom want to talk to you. For all of this journeying you've made in your life, two immigrations, feeling not quite a part of English life, then coming to Canada, yet as you've also drawn to some extent on Tamil tradition as a storyteller, you've talked in interviews that I've read about the great tradition of storytelling that you grew up with, your parents, and there's a wonderful line that in the Tamil tradition, in the Sri Lankan tradition, a well-told lie is worth a thousand facts. I just love that line. And it seems that through all your journeys, you haven't lost touch with at least some part of those roots.
Very much so. And I think there's an odd kind of humor that I think comes out of that childhood, you know, recognition of how your uncles told lies or told stories, you know. They just exaggerated a bit too much to be fully believable, but they're possibly true. You know, I think that's a nice area of between fiction and nonfiction, I think.
And that's a vein or a borderline you've walked your whole life. And, you know, the other thing that you was quoted as saying that I thought was so interesting was a saying that in the East, the artist follows the brush. And that seemed to me to describe very well how you wrote this novel. You started with a germ and then it just, you followed your brush.
Right. I mean, I think it's a tradition of I think Donald Ritchie, the wonderful American who lives in Japan now, talks about the distinction between East and West, how the West kind of has a very, very organized structure for a book. And it's so well organized, so linear, so chronological, mm-hmm. that it's not quite real. Whereas in the East, in Japan specifically, he's talking about this, you have the sense of bricolage. You start having lists of things and scattered scenes. And these scenes, when you step back, give you a different kind of perspective of the same episode. And the artist following the brush so that you're following the plot, following the sentences into a new story.
So even though you haven't been back to Sri Lanka in a long time, don't speak Tamil anymore except for a few rude phrases, mm-hmm. but it stayed with you.
Yeah, it stayed with me. You know, and I think that's how I write my books. I know, you know, I did not know the prisoner was going to come into the book at all when I began the book, but then suddenly this prisoner appears and you know, there's a new plot element to it. And that is a complication.
It's one of your favorite passages in the book, so if you could read briefly about the prisoner, it would be great.
Sure. Late at night, after the specially invited first-class passengers had left the captain's table, and after the dancing had ended with couples, their masks removed, barely stirring in each other's arms, and after the stewards had taken away the abandoned glasses and ashtrays and were leaning on the 4-foot-wide brooms to sweep away the colored swirls of paper, they brought out the prisoner. It was usually before midnight. The deck shone because of a cloudless moon. He appeared with the guards, one chained to him, one walking behind him with a baton. We did not know what his crime was. We assumed it could only have been a murder. The concept of anything more intricate, such as a crime of passion or a political betrayal, did not exist in us then. He looked powerful, self-contained, and he was barefoot. Cassius had discovered this late-night schedule for the prisoner's walk, so the three of us were often there at that hour. He could, we thought among ourselves, leap over the railing along with the guard who was chained to him into the dark sea. We thought of him running and leaping this way to his death. We thought this, I suppose, because we were young. The very idea of a chain of being contained was like suffocation. At our age, we could not endure the idea of it. We could hardly stand to wear sandals when we went for meals. And every night as we ate at our table in the dining room, we imagined the prisoner eating scraps from a metal tray, barefoot, in his cell.
We have a lot of folks who want to talk with you, but Jim from Brick, New Jersey asked us a question that many of our listeners have asked. Going back to The English Patient, were you happy with the movie adaptation? And others add, how has this changed your life? You became an international figure in a way that you hadn't before.
Yeah, it was like being struck by lightning. And I think the main thing, the way I remember that whole episode of my life was that I became very close friends with Anthony Minghella, who was the writer and the director, and Saul Zanz, who was the producer. And there was a great closeness between us. So, you know, it's difficult for me to kind of judge the film because we were so close, and the whole process of the film being made by, you know, essentially the three of us, though I didn't have any official role, meant that I couldn't step out inside and look back and see what was really good or not good or what. But I think it worked amazingly, you know, and I loved working with Minghella and with Walter Murch, who was the editor on the film, and Saul Zanz. So I learned a lot. I was interested in being a part of it because I love any kind of craft. You know, I loved how the script was written, how Anthony would say, only one person in the film can have a flashback. You know, if you have more people having flashbacks, it's going to be utterly confusing to the audience. And your book has, everyone has a flashback. So, you know, various things that were certain rules of the film world were kind of, I got from the horse's mouth, you know, and I have no desire to work in film myself, but it taught me a lot because I can learn from film just as I can learn from music or painting.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Fascinating. Now let's talk to some of our callers, and let's start with Joyce in Tacoma, Washington. Welcome. You're on The Diane Rehm Show, Joyce.
Good morning. I just wanted to say that your book struck a real chord with me. As a child, I've always felt I was in a bubble looking around and observing other people and events, and that no one could really see me. I also found your book to be very lyrical, almost musical. I couldn't put it down. It's wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I think there was something about, you know, entering that world of the 11-year-old that, you know, allowed me to kind of have them all be in a kind of bubble. And it is a kind of surreal situation anyway, being on a ship, which is totally separate from the rest of the world.
It's surreal being a child, too.
Thank you, Joyce. Do you have grandchildren?
Yes, I do.
And are they, what ages are they?
The youngest is about 6 months, and the other is about 15. The oldest is about 15.
So you have revisited that stage of life. It must have been just about 11 when you were writing the book.
That's right. That's right.
Was that useful?
It was useful. You know, I guess when I wrote the book, I was sort of in my own head, though. You know,
uh-huh.
I mean, I didn't interrogate him about being
James in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, James.
Good morning. Thank you so much, gentlemen. It's a pleasure to get to talk to you, Mr. Andonche.
Thank you.
I actually got to hear you read a number of years ago in Coral Gables with Russell Banks. I don't know if you recall that, perhaps,
mm-hmm.
but...
Mm-hmm.
I was calling, you know, I was always curious in your poetry, and I love your collection called Handwriting, particularly the Nine Sentiments. It's always been one of my favorites. I always felt they were such complete statements, but it was always curious to me your use of geographic names in the poems, and I always wanted to ask you, is it the rhythms in the sounds of those names, or did you actually want to use things like Galipitigala Road because that's the place maybe where you were writing that? Or it was always curious to me, and I just want you to know your poetry has always been an inspiration. So
thank you. Yeah, I love using geographical names. You know, even in an early book like The Collected Works of Billy the Kid, the Mescalero territory was used because I loved the sound of the word Mescalero. And my last novel before this one was called Divisadero, which is the street in San Francisco. And Galipitigama Road is a beautiful sound of for a name. But I like to have those names almost like tacking down a reality to the poems. It was rather like earlier on when we were talking about when you write fiction, you want to be basing it in a way on nonfiction to a certain extent. And place names and the names of, I know, soda waters and so forth. All of those things are, for me, very kind of tactile, real objects in a lyric.
Do you make lists as you travel or as you read of words that have those, that power for you, that you say, I'm going to write a poem that's going to include this word or this place?
Sometimes I do. Sometimes the name just comes to me at the time because it fits into the rhythm of the poem or the sentence, I think. But I mean, if there's something very unusual, I will sometimes write that down, a piece of information. I was told something the other day that the Sri Lankan alphabet has 126 letters, but no W and no F. And that was new to me.
But as we were talking earlier, names have a very special power,
right.
Either to locate yourself in a geographic place or, as in your case and in my case, conveying an identity, but not necessarily the full identity. It is a very powerful way that we present ourselves to the world.
Definitely. Even a name like Mina suggests a great deal. Even a nickname suggests a great deal. And, you know, it wasn't until I finished the book that I realized that most of the names in the Cat's Table are foreign names. You know, even Miss Laskiti, who's English, has a foreign name. And so I think a lot of my books have that kind of quality of the other being within the Western sphere.
Exactly. Michael Ondaatje. His book is The Cat's Table. We're going to be back with more of your calls, more of your emails. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by ESET, offering home internet security with parental controls to fight spam, viruses, and cybercrime. ESET.com. By Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, now that Newt Gingrich is having an unexpected surge in the polls, we talk with Karen Tumulty, who's covered him for years. She's a national political correspondent for The Washington Post. We'll look at his political career and how he became a wealthy man after he left Congress by what she describes as playing the Washington system in an entrepreneurial way. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, and my guest this hour is the novelist Michael Ondaatje, well known to many of you as the author of the Booker Prize-winning novel *The English Patient*, made into the Oscar-winning movie. But his new novel, *The Cat's Table*, is just out, and we've been talking about it. 1-800-433-8850 is our phone number. drshow@wamu.org, our email address. Let's turn, Michael, to Lisa in Woodstock, Connecticut. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, Lisa.
Oh, yes. Thank you very much. I just tuned in, and I wasn't sure who was being interviewed, but the descriptions of being on an ocean liner as a child were just immediately so familiar to me. I was born in New Zealand. And between the ages of 5 and about 15, my family and I traveled back and forth from New Zealand to the West Coast on the Arance, the Oriana, the Ruahine, a lot of the P&O Orient lines. And I did the exact same thing. I found some pals, and we would race around the ship completely unsupervised. We would find the ways to get from into first class and see how the other half lives.
My God, you must be my sister.
Did you steal food like Michael's character?
I beg your pardon?
Did you steal food like Michael's character in Cat's Table?
We didn't steal food, but we we found also ways to get to the crew's quarters, and who were quite rough, and one of them pulled a knife on us, I think really just as a bluff. But it was terrifying, and it was sort of seemed like something out of Robinson Crusoe at the time, and I've never forgotten it. You know, dacoits, the captain's table, the dances. As I got a bit older, I could accompany my parents to the dances. Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, going through the Panama Canal, my first French words with the children in the nursery with me when we stopped at Tahiti, learning how to say comment allez-vous to the children there, and watching them draw pictures in the nursery of the silhouette of Mo'orea, the island that they might have come from, a tidal wave warning when we docked in Honolulu. All of these things are just such rich memories for me, and you were just absolutely describing my experience, and also my experience of going to school in New Zealand after having gone to high school in the United States. To a private school that was very English, seemed very Dickensian to me at the time.
Thank you so much for your call. We really appreciate it, Lisa.
I think one of these interesting things is that the book has sort of woken up a whole number of people who went by ship during a certain era. You know, I mean, it's unusual now, but all the early part of the 20th century, people in Asia or in the Caribbean sure. went to school, you know, in England, perhaps, by ship. And there was, you know, many, many generations where it was almost a habit.
Well, you know, and that gets to something that's been remarked upon by a number of British critics that say, we talked earlier about this being a classic immigrant story of a child on this boat, comes to a new country where he never feels at home. And one of the writers in The Observer in London said this was very much part of the tradition of colonial literature, that so many expats had that special experience of growing up in an outpost of the empire and coming back to England to school, their putative homeland, but never really feeling at home there either.
Yeah, I mean, the tradition was in Sri Lanka certainly was that if you sent your kids, if you could afford it, to school in England, and with luck they went to Oxford or Cambridge, and the important thing was to get a blue in rowing or cricket, and then you came back to the family firm of lawyers or doctors. And I think our generation was the first generation that never really went back. So, but I mean, if I go back now, I know many people there who are the sons of doctors who are now doctors who went to England for their schooling.
And never went back.
And never went. Well, no, these ones went back.
These ones did go back. You know, you've also awakened some of your fans, as well as ocean liner aficionados. Here's an email from John who writes to us, I was a student in Michael Ondaatje's fiction writing course at Brown University. Oh. His work, Coming Through Slaughter, made such a big impression on me that I wrote home about it.
That's great.
What is that a poem?
No, Coming Through Slaughter is a novel about jazz, actually. It's about Buddy Bolden, the jazz musician in New Orleans. So it was my first novel. And I wrote it, in the early 80s, I guess. And it's still a favorite novel of mine. It's a pretty tight and punchy and angry and jazzy.
Susan from Columbia, Maryland writes, The Cinnamon Peeler is one of the most erotic poems I've ever read. I've never looked at cinnamon in quite the same way. You're an amazing stylist and storyteller.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
You want to quote a line from The Cinnamon Peeler?
I can't. I'm not good at that. But I'll tell you one story. Somebody wanted it read at their wedding. And so somebody came and read the poem at the wedding, and this person's aunt fainted.
I guess it really was erotic then.
It was too erotic, but it was erotic, yeah.
And then we have an email from Marcel in Tampa, Florida, says, Thank you for all your books. My wife and I have enjoyed them for years. Thanks especially for In the Skin of a Lion and Divisadero, both of which I've read time and time again. Please settle an argument. My wife and I have. At the end of In the Skin of a Lion is Patrick's journey to destroy the waterworks a dream. It is a reflection of his father's dream of blasting the heart of a man.
That's very interesting, because I want it both ways, because he falls asleep, and then the next chapter is the scene where he goes to the waterworks. But I've never kind of admitted if it's a dream or a reality.
And so you're not going to do it now
I'm
either.
I'm not going to do it now, but thank you for picking that up.
Well, as you have said many times, we talked earlier about you know, the great tradition in Sri Lanka is a well-told lie is better than a thousand facts. So you keep there's always an air of mystery in your books. You know, sometimes you never quite say what the real truth is. Excellent, but a perceptive reader nonetheless. Let's talk to Gary in Date Run, North Carolina. Welcome, you're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you very much, Michael. Your book, The Visadero, is one of the most beautiful stories that I've ever read. As a truck driver, I've been in many areas of the United States, and I've listened to many audio books. Hope Davis read that audio, recorded the audio. What role does the writer have in who actually gets to read and record their audio books? And do you think The Visadero would make a good movie? Because I believe it could make a very good movie. And I thank you for a wonderful, wonderful story. And I'll hear your response off the air.
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you. Yeah, it's one of my favorite books, too. So I have to say that emotionally, I feel very, very close to De Visadero. And I thought the Hope Davis reading was fantastic. They usually kind of suggest names, and sometimes I say no, yes. And in fact, for The Cat's Table, I read it myself. It seemed to be the right voice, the kind of semi-fictional voice. But, I do listen to some many, many books on tape if I can, if I'm driving, you know. And it does make a huge difference, and they don't always work either. But I love the one of De Visadero.
What was your experience of reading it yourself? I've had that experience of doing the audio book the audio version of an own book, and it's an interesting experience.
It was very interesting for me because I read it just about the time the book was printed, so long before I did any readings, and so I just sat down and read it in over about 3 or 4 days, and I was actually shocked how intimate it was. You know, it's a very intimate book. I'm talking about The Cat's Table, which surprised me. I thought it was an outgoing book, and it is an outgoing book, but there's so much kind of intimate description in of the boy's mind and what the boy is feeling that I was very surprised by that.
Fascinating. Let's talk to Sriram in Chevy Chase. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
Thank you very much, Steve. Hello, Michael. I'm also Tamil, come to the United States by way of Britain, but after college. We've read a lot of your books, my wife and I, and I especially like The English Patient, and I thought the movie rendering did a lot of, was pretty faithful to the book. But I'm curious, you have a unique style. What are the books that you read, and who are the authors that inspire you? Could you name two or three of them?
I mean, one of the writers who I admire a great deal, I'm not quite sure if he influenced me or not, but I'm very fond of him, is John Berger. He's an English writer who lives in France, and he was well-known as an art critic for a while. But in fact, his novels, the novel G, that's a letter G, or a recent one called Here Is Where We Meet, a wonderful writer. And the most recent book is called Bento's Sketchbook, which is published by Pantheon, which is a book of his drawings and his musings and letters. And I love writers who range across the genres, like Berger. Berger draws, he does nonfiction, he writes fiction, he writes political statements. D.H. Lawrence wrote poems, he wrote fiction and nonfiction. And a young writer like Jeff Dyer does the same kind of thing. I'm very interested in writers who kind of are not limited to just the fiction or to poetry.
Well, we were talking earlier about how one of the characters becomes a painter,
right?
And tries to express the sensibilities of the journey through his art, whereas Michael does it through his words. So that filters into your sensibility in the book.
You know, I think one of the things that's interesting to me is that I feel I'm not influenced by other writers at all. You know, I mean, I read other writers. I'm sure I am subliminally, but I feel I'm influenced by painting. I feel I'm influenced by music. Louis Armstrong's Hot 5 and Hot 7 recordings changed me utterly. Diego Rivera's frescoes changed me utterly. And I'm sure lots of bad songs like Poison Ivy by the Coasters changed me. But, you know, I immediately want to kind of have that element of music and art in my books, you know. And whereas if I'm reading a writer I really admire like Don DeLillo, I'm not sure I'm influenced by him, but I there's a great pleasure in being inside his book.
In fact, I've seen you quoted that every time you finish a book, you're convinced that it's going to be your last one. You've said everything you want to say and that your next step is to learn how to play the piano.
That's right, and I keep putting it off.
You haven't done that yet.
No, but I was thinking about it the other day, actually.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Michael Andace, we have time for a couple of more of our callers, and let's turn to Christine in Arlington, Texas. Welcome. You're on The Diane Rehm Show.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello there. I would like to thank you, first of all, for the many, many hours of pure, unadulterated pleasure your books have given me.
Thank you.
You're welcome. They are like money in the bank that never disappears because one can reread them.
Thanks
and
so much.
You're welcome so much. I wanted to also share a couple of things. One is to thank you for coming through Slaughter, which is one of the strangest, most beautiful books I've ever read about any musician.
You're breaking up, Christine, I'm afraid. But thank you very much for the call. Let's talk to Sally in Dallas, Texas. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, Sally.
Thank you so much, Mr. Andante. I had the pleasure of acting in your play, The Collected Works of Billy the Kid, at the Dallas Theater Center a number of years ago. And to this day, it remains one of my most favorite experiences, in a play.
Mm-hmm.
Your words, to bring them to life, it's just thrilling. And there's so much there to mine. I wondered two things. If you have any new plays coming up in the next years, do you think? And how is your process of writing plays different from or informed by your work as a novelist?
There is a stage version of Divisadero that was done last January in Toronto, and they're redoing it this January and February in Toronto. And it just takes one section of the novel, the California section, and it's not quite a play. I don't think my plays are really full plays in the Noel Coward sense, as you probably know that.
Right.
But there is a kind of pleasure in hearing the words out loud for me and the interaction between characters on stage. So I don't think I'm really a playwright, but they are adaptations of books. Make them as dramatic as possible.
Yeah, well, thank you for that work.
Thank you.
Thanks, Allie. Talk to Anne in St. Louis, Missouri. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, Anne.
Hi, I just finished The Cat's Table, and I loved it. I just had to get the book when the reviews said that it took place on the Aranse. I traveled on the Aranse, and we got on the ship in California and got off in Naples. I well remember the stop in Colombo. I was traveling with three friends. We were college students at the time, and we also had some adventures that were kind of against the rules, traveling to parts of the ships that were off limits.
Mm-hmm.
But it was almost a magical time being on the ship. It was a time out of reality in a way. And your book brought back many memories. I had to go back and read my diary. So I thank you for your lovely novel as well as for the memories.
Thank you. It is strange that two people today have actually called who had been on the Aranse, you know. And I was doing a reading somewhere recently, and someone came with a menu from one of the Aranse that their parents had given them.
Yes, I think I still have some of those in my scrapbook.
Really?
What was it about that ship? Anne, stay on the line. What was it about that ship that had such power over both of you?
Well, I think partly for us, it was such a different experience because it was a British ship. So for Americans, you know, having tea in the afternoon and the people, the British, just that whole British atmosphere was something new and exciting. But also, I don't know, just being on the ocean, being separate from the rest of the world, it just it's a whole different feeling.
Thank you, Anne.
It's a bit like space travel today. You know, you're in this kind of booth for you're many, many years away in the future and you come back to a reality, you know, it must be very strange.
We only had about a minute left. we were joking that you might learn how to play the piano, but I'm sure a lot of your fans, and so many of them called in, are wondering what's next for you.
Actually, nothing is there in the future for me at the moment. You know, I really do finish a book and think, well, that's it. You know, I can't think of a thing more to write. And I don't know how long it takes for me to kind of get back to a desk again, but no ideas except the piano possibility.
And what about the possibility of turning a Cat's Table into a movie? Has that been raised?
It hasn't. I mean, I haven't kind of asked them to send it out or anything like that. But, you know, the problem, I think, is how do you have the youth section and the adult section, you know, and you would not want to lose either one, obviously. So maybe there's a way of doing it. You know, I seem to create these books that are very difficult to film. And everyone said to Anthony Minghella, you can make a film out of The English Patient.
Well, they did. So yeah. Hopefully we'll see another one from The Cat's Table. Michael Ondaatje, what a pleasure to spend an hour with you this morning. Michael's new book is The Cat's Table, a novel. As many of you know, author also of The English Patient, many other plays, novels, and poems, which many of our listeners have mentioned this morning. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, and she wants our listeners to know that her husband, John, is doing very well after surgery. He's making a good recovery, and she's planning to be back in this chair on Monday. Thanks for spending an hour with us.
Thanks, Steve.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.